I don't usually use this space to discuss an upcoming guest, but Dahlia McCutcheon is no ordinary Yang slinger. So, as many of you know, I'm working on a Tupac Shakur biography, and Dahlia used to date Tupac, and she wrote about the relationship in her self-published memoir, I Testify. That's why I bought the book on Amazon, to learn about Tupac. But I Testify blew me away. Really, Dahlia's life journey blew me away. She moved from Philadelphia to Houston as a young girl, was beaten and abused by her mother, and molested by her mother's boyfriend. She was kidnapped by a pimp. She became a stripper. She suffered all sorts of mental and physical abuse, and she wrote about it in her really gripping, powerful, raw memoir. So you'll hear a bit about Tupac, but I really wanted to focus on the life and times of Dahlia. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writer with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Dahlia McCutcheon, the author of an absolutely gripping memoir titled I Testify. This is episode number 304. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks.
And nobody cares about your stupid TV show.
So I'm writing a book on Tupac, which I've talked about, and I've been deep diving. And a friend of yours said, you need to speak to my friend. And she said she wrote a book. My Tupac library is about 50 books deep. I order every book about Tupac. So I ordered your book, I Testify. And it came out in 2017. You self-published it. I honestly initially was just skimming it to find the Tupac stuff. And I'm reading this book and I keep going to my wife, holy shit. Just so readers have an understand, I just want to give some background here. You're born in 1974. You're from Philly. You moved to Texas and Houston with your mom when she marries a guy, a military guy. And your mom was rough. From your book, you wrote, the beating began every time my yaya hit me and I looked at my sister with hatred, with rage. My yaya had grabbed a pipe and began telling me how much of a whore I was and kept asking me, bitch, you want to know what it feels like to be fucked over and over? And I knew at some point she was going to shove that pipe inside of me, but that never happened. She hit me a few times with it and I wanted to lay down and die. I recall her balling up her fist and punching me dead in the face. And then out of nowhere, she punched me in the mouth. And that is when I tasted the blood that entered my mouth once again. The taste of my own blood became very familiar. My yaya would walk away, come back, and punch me in the face as hard as she could until I saw stars. The punches in the chest and the kicks were not as bad as her spitting in my face. Yes, she spit in my face, the nastiest thing a person can do to you. I mean, did your mom read the book? And did you need her at all to own up to what she did?
To my understanding, she did not read the book. She heard about the book. And I think that everyone that told her about the book gave their own version, which stirred a lot of chaos with what I wrote. Has there been any owning up? I would say probably not. It's hard for us as individuals, you know, even today, to be accountable. You know, and I don't want to, you know, speak too much on as to what she would need to be accountable for, but
maybe beating the shit out of you as a kid.
You know, I say this and I don't want to cross too many lines, but as you know, as we all know, a lot of children undergo physical and mental abuse at the hands of people that love that are supposed to love them. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is, and I can speak from experience, whether it's yaya, mama, grandmother, grandpa, the man that you love, a lot of the times they don't accept what they did. They're not accepting the responsibility. They're not, you know, being accountable. And it's because they see things very differently than how we see it. As a person who has experienced abuse across the board, I no longer worry about, or nor am I waiting for the accountability, being responsible for, or even saying I'm sorry. You have to know that that is either who they were, what they became, or what they became because of what they went through.
Right.
Never know what a person went through in their early years. So can they be accountable? I don't know. Because what if they went through something and the person that abused them or mistreated them or, you know, mentally mind fuck them, right? And they never got the, I'm sorry, I apologize, I didn't mean to do what I did. What if they never got it and they don't know the first step in being accountable or knowing how to say, I'm sorry?
Would it not work for you to go up to your mom and say, I'm sort of curious, what happened to you that made you this way?
I think that I've wanted to do that. I have not done that. There, you know, there are conversations, you know, that are had, but, you know, they're in the 50s, 60s, 40s, you know, a lot of things aren't talked about. A lot of things are meant to be, you know, shunned on, close your mouth, don't say anything. What goes on in this house is our business. So a lot of things back in those early days were meant to be covered up. Rapes, abuse, you know, they're covered up. And so when they're covered up and you live your life being silent and being quiet, I think you tend to live your life like that, just being quiet and not being accountable.
I just want to say again, like, I really felt this book. Like, I really felt it. And it's funny because I know in a way, one of the reasons you wrote it was to sort of share your faith and how God got you through it. And I'm like a kind of non-believing Jewish agnostic atheist. And
I love it.
It didn't really matter to me. Like, to me, it wasn't about that. It was more about strength, determination, not giving in, moving forward, not taking any shit, not being stopped. And to sort of explain to people what you went through here, you were molested when you were six. Mm-hmm. You were physically abused by your mother. You ran away from home. It's mind blowing. I kept saying this to my wife. You were basically, in a sense, kidnapped by a pimp. You later became a stripper. One thing after another, one abusive man after another. Like, in a way, weirdly, sometimes you'll be reading your book and you'll think, oh, this guy, he seems like a pretty decent guy. And you're like, oh, wait, he's 27 dating a 15-year-old. Like, it's insane. Insane. And I am kind of curious, like, what made you think? I mean, you work as a healthcare recruiter, you know, like you do not, your background, I know you've written, but your background is not as a professional writer. Like, what made you say, I need to put this all down on paper?
Ooh, well, it's something that I've wanted to do since I was about 16. And as you read in the book, to have a story at 16 years old, to have that much to talk about at 16 years old, that was my goal. My goal was, I'm going to write a book one day about this, but still having to go through it. And I'll embellish on the whole pimp thing. The crazy part about that is the beatings with that was because I wouldn't allow that man to prostitute me out. And it was so crazy because I remember saying, I'm going to write a book about this one day. How, you know, here's this grown ass man, right? And to have that thought process, this grown man trying to prostitute me at 15, 16 years old. And I'm saying, at that time, you know, if I sell my body, I'm going to keep my money. That was my mindset. Like, if I'm going to sell my body, it will be for myself. And I got the shit kicked out of me because I was like, I'm not going in there. I'm not doing that. And every time those sorts of things happened, it was as if a typewriter was going off in my head. I knew I wasn't, my vocabulary was very limited, but the words that would typewrite themselves in my head, I knew that when I decided to write a book, that I would write the book in a way that I think you can understand. I'm not talking to an audience, I'm talking to my reader. And that's what I wanted. It's not like, here's this intellectual, huge vocabulary of words. I needed it to be authentic and transparent. I needed it to be in the words that would come out of my mouth. So if I say, bitch, you whooped my ass, that is what, you know, I needed the book to be. That's why I needed the book to be presented. I didn't need the book to be presented in a way where, you know, it's like she had to use all of these big words to get a point across. No, wow. I'm a chick from Philly, from South Philly. So it was what made me write the book. It was, it had been embedded in me. since I was young. And that it was just something I've always wanted to. I used to tell people in middle school, I'm going to write a book one day. Because I had a story that started at six.
You really dove into sort of what it was to be a little kid and have the trust violation of being molested. Mm-hmm. And you wrote, "This is how he made himself feel good, touching my tiny body, kissing me in a way that I knew was wrong, but too afraid of the consequences if I told what he'd been doing. He promised me that there would be suffering if I told, and then no one would believe me anyway. He would get my little sister bathed and out of the way so he could have his way with me. He never touched my then one-year-old sister, did anything to hurt her, but it was I who made him feel like a man." People view writing in two different ways mainly, which is, number one, when I write something very personal, it can be cathartic for me and it can make me sort of the pain go away to a certain degree. And then there are other people who they write and it relitigates the pain and the pain comes back and they have to deal with it again. Writing about being molested as a six-year-old, something I'm guessing you tried to suppress in the decades that passed. What was that to you?
Horrific. Challenging. There's still the silent cries within my soul that wants to reach out to that little girl and say, "It's okay. You're going to come out of this. The truth of the matter is you don't forget it." What is that to me? It's hurtful. It's traumatic. It's damaging. It is an everlasting feeling of being violated. Something you can't take back. Something you can't give back. It's something that you try to forgive. For me, it is still, to this day, horrific. It's a tragedy. I actually reached out to that person via Facebook, and I gave that person 72 hours to contact me. It was a couple of years ago, and I wanted to know why. They never responded. They created another social media outlet. And they read it because Facebook tells you when someone reads your message. And so I said everything that I've ever wanted to say over the last 40 something years. And my last words were, "I hope that every single day that you live the rest of your life, you are in fear of what could happen to your daughters."
Why didn't you name the guy?
Why didn't I?
Yeah.
A lot of people I didn't name in the book simply because I knew that a lot of people would come for me. They would have a lot to say. And I really didn't want to give them that power, because the power behind this book is the power of me, the power of what I survived. Although, you know, they're in the book, it's not about them. It's what I went through with them. But what I got out of it and what I overcame from it. So a lot of people were not, you know, I think a few times, you know, Yaya is called mom. But again, there was a reason behind that. I didn't feel the necessity of naming this person or that person.
When you wrote that guy, your rapist, when you wrote him over Facebook, did you feel a certain way? Did your hands get sweaty?
My hands got sweaty. I got hot. I had hot flashes. My ears got hot. I never knew your ears could get hot. But my ears got hot. And I was like, "Oh my God." And I just felt this weird feeling in the pit of my stomach. And it was so, it felt like I was giving birth and had never given birth before. Uh-huh. So it felt like giving birth, it felt like fire. It felt like I was a volcano. And it was so, like, I feel hot right now just talking about it. Like, I feel a sweat. Like, honestly, I feel a sweat.
And what did you want from him? Like, what did you want? Let's say he responded.
To own it. To own it. Because, you know, it happened 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. Own your shit. And that's what I wanted. I wanted him to own his shit. And the coward that he was, he tucked his tail and he ran. And I still said what I needed to say. And you read it.
Yeah.
But did I get what I needed to get out of it? The fact that he read it, I got some of what I needed. But what I feel to this day, I want to see you face to face. I want you to look me in my face. I want you to tell me why. What was it that ran through your head at 21, 22 years old to want to sit and smoke weed with a 6, 7, 8, 9 year old, to want to place your penis, I call it a pepper, you know, yeah. to put your pepper, you know, between a child's legs. What is it? What was it? And it is a sickness. It is a disease. And, you know, again, you hide it. You place it under a rug. He'll never be accountable.
Let's say it's like next week and you're at the, I'm going to Houston on you. You're at the Willowbrook Mall and you see this guy walking the other way and you know it's him. You're like, mm-hmm. That's fucking him. That's him. Do you go up to him?
I would.
Yeah.
I would. It would probably be a very viral moment.
Yeah.
It would probably be a very viral moment. So absolutely.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I? Because that would be my moment of truth. That would be the moment that I can look at you in your face and say every single thing that I wanted to say from a 6-year-old, from a 9-year-old, a 16-year-old, a 25-year-old, a 30-year-old. Because here's the thing. When something like that happens to you, whether you're male or female, there's two things that happen in your life. You're going to be super promiscuous or you're going to be a prude as fuck. For me, I became very dominant in my relationships. I had to be in control, whether it was mentally, physically, sexually, and it always didn't work out that way. But when it came, and this is super personal, but when it's time for me to be intimate, I have to be in control. And I think that's from being molested, from being raped. I don't like being bound, meaning, you know, I don't want you to hold my wrist down. Or, you know, I dated a police officer once and he handcuffed me and I broke up with him that night. Like it hadn't even gotten to that point. I hate handcuffs. But there, you know, I have to be in control. Giving control is okay, but a certain level of control. And I've learned to kind of step back from that. But as a child that was molested, as a rape survivor, I've yet to be able to give that control. I just pop my knuckles because every time I talk about it, I have to pop my knuckles.
There's no fully escaping it, right? There's no like, there's not no. AA when you're going to be like, all right, I'm better. I'm recovered. Like that doesn't exist, I'm guessing, fully.
I'm still healing. I talked to my friend who, one of my good friends who's a therapist, and she says, you need therapy because I can be a very angry person. I have a saying, and it's something that I used to, you know, tell Pac, and he said, you'll always be that way. And I used to say, I'm the right woman to love you, but I'm the wrong woman to hate you. My rage is so far worse than my love. And, you know, my love is giving. It's everything that we should be as women. We should be loving and nurturing. And I'm all of those things. But when the light switch comes off and turn off that light switch and there's that other side and she is written in the book. She is very real. She is very dangerous. And it's a very real thing.
So I'm interested as a writer, like you decide you're going to do this book.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to self-publish. It's your story of survival and sort of emergence. And you're writing about one tragic, haunting moment after another from your life.
Mm-hmm.
Are you literally sitting down at a laptop and going like, hoo to hoo to hoo and typing away? Or like, how are you? Because it can't be the same as me writing a Tupac book where I'm writing and I'm 5 steps removed from Tupac and he's over there and my life is here. And there's a certain layer of comfort because I'm not, you know, I'm not getting shot in Las Vegas. I'm not experiencing these things, but you did. Everything you wrote about, you experienced. Were you able to just sit down at a laptop and have a coffee to your side and type away?
You know, I was homeless at times. So, you know, whether it was on a piece of paper or a brown paper bag or something that I was scribbling on, those were the things that I did. My process was very different.
Wait, you know? So through the years, you're homeless, on and on and on. You're taking notes, you're writing shit on paper bags, and you have all these scraps of paper, and you're like Eminem in 8 Mile, where you have all these different notes and different things. And when this writing this book is really, in a way, a compilation of notes you've taken along the way.
And some notes were lost. A lot of those notes were embedded in my spirit. And so, you know, like you said earlier, I had to relive all of this because some of the notes that I no longer had that have been trashed along the way or I've lost along the way, you know, while being homeless, I had to sit down with myself and cry my way through the book. And there were stopping moments. There were moments where I just couldn't do it. And I ended up putting the book down and writing another book because I couldn't get through some of the things that I had gone through. I couldn't move forward because this was hurtful. This changed the trajectory of my life. Hold on, stop. I stopped and I started writing The Shift. And so The Shift for me was therapy because I was going through a horrible situation, you know, with the person I was dating. I was being stalked. I was being taunted. And so I wrote another book, which was the first book, to suppress what it was that I was feeling, because I was feeling all kinds of emotions. I was feeling all of this. It was a whirlwind of chaos in my head.
I just want to tell for people listening, The Shift is your first book.
The Shift is your first book.
Right. It's a collective of inspiring stories that you sort of put together, just so people know. Okay.
Yes. Yes. And so that was the book that I needed to write. I had to step away. And so when I finished The Shift and I got to a point where I feel like I was in this self-healing phase of my life, it was like there the word started just flooding through my mind. And I wrote and wrote and wrote and just relived every single thing, every tragic thing, every tragic person that I ever had to experience. I had to sit in front of this computer and relive it from, you know, someone trying to pimp me, someone trying to get me to sell my body, someone trying to turn me into a prostitute, someone, you know, trying to force me, you know, to do this and having to run out of a situation. I had to relive all of that.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my daughter, Casey, who keeps singing the same NCT 127 song over and over and over.
Girl, you're my favorite.
Oh my God, this is so unbearable.
Girl, you're my favorite.
Ugh, I get it. You love K-pop.
Girl, you're my favorite.
But this has to end, please.
K-pop? Dad, this isn't about K-pop. It's about RoyalRetros.com, the kings of throwback sports merchandise. I've tried buying a Greg Landry Chicago Blitz jersey from other places, but it's impossible. That's why I sing.
I kind of get it, but who's the girl?
Dad, it's a metaphor.
Girl, you're my favorite. I just want to say, sincerely, I'm holding up the book. People listening can't hear it. And I literally wrote here, holy shit. And it's me marking a page. And what you wrote here, all right, this is about you literally getting raped. And this is how you wrote about it. You wrote, as his body became one with mine, I could feel everything inside of me dying slowly. So I lay there hoping that death would enter the room and take me. He was pounding the inside of my vaginal walls, hoping to get aroused, but the alcohol kept him from getting any harder than he was, and that angered him. Then came the worst feeling I had ever felt in my life. He lifted both of my legs in the air and rammed his penis into my anus, and that is when his manhood had gotten hard. It was the first time I had screamed to the top of my lungs, and that is when he grabbed me by my throat again, and my body jerked at the loss of his breath. He was choking me to death, and he wouldn't let up. And I was thinking about this, like, you're writing this and it's fucking beyond powerful. It is insanely powerful. But you're a mom of two kids. You have a job. You have a career. Your name is on the book. Your name, presumably everyone knows your name, where you work, and when you go about life. And I'm being sincere. I know you're laughing, but I actually do mean it. Like, did you think at all, okay, I'm putting this all out here. It's going to be really real. And people who know me and may not know, there might be the woman where you work who, you know, makes coffee every morning. And she's like this pleasant white woman from Cleveland. And she's like, oh, there's Dahlia. Hey. And like, now she's going to be like, did you think about the implications and the ramifications of writing with such raw force?
I did. It was the scariest feeling, because I did not know how people were going to take it, how it was going to be perceived. And the crazy part about it is, yes, I am a mother, and I am a mother of a 17-year-old daughter. And I'm the blueprint. I no longer think about what people feel, how they feel, what they'll say about the book, how they'll feel about the book, how the woman who's sitting having a latte is going to feel about the book, because we don't know what she's going through or what she's been through. It doesn't matter that she's a white woman who's sitting having a latte, or the millionaire white woman, or the millionaire black woman, or the Chinese woman that is a refuge from, we don't know what they've gone through. So I shut that out. I completely shut that out of my head, because I used to worry about what someone is going to say, how they're going to feel, what they're going to say when they read this book, how they're going to look at me. I don't give a fuck anymore. Because I survived that shit. I came out of that shit. So if Becky across the street and Shaquita down the street, you know, need to read the book and feel something, you'll get something out of it. Because you're looking at me, we're having this conversation, and you would never know that my mouth was wired shut, or that both of my eyes were completely closed, or I couldn't talk because I had to sit through a straw, or that I'd been shot because my ex-boyfriend decided that he wanted to kill me and attempt to kill himself. You know, I don't care what people think, because the person that's sitting having a latte, regardless of their race, regardless of their gender, if they've gone through something and they read this story, my story, which is very real, I survived that. And if you can get something out of that and find strength in that, in whatever it is that you're going through, whether it's an abusive relationship or you just lost your job or whatever it is that you're going through, you may just be having a fucked up day and look at someone's life that has gone through some shit and look at yourself in the mirror and say, it's not that bad. I read something about someone that should be dead. So I don't care anymore about what people think.
You know, you and I are about the same age, and I think I have 2 years on you. And don't you think as you get older, it's a lesson you really learned, is that everyone has their shit. Mm-hmm. And like everyone has their shit. Everyone, every single person has their shit. And when you're younger, you really worry about, oh, what are they going to think about me? And oh, I'm so embarrassed because blank. And then you get older and you realize, like, that guy over there, he's going through a divorce. That guy over there,
yes,
he's having sex with the secretary. That guy over there, that woman over there. We all have our shit. It's like one of the most liberating things in the world is to realize you're no more crazy or messed up than anybody else.
Right. Right. But again, it's, for me, it's a blueprint. You know, as a mother of a daughter, it's a blueprint. And so when you can have something like this book, and it's a blueprint, and the world that we live in today, and the things that, you know, we go through, and the things that this generation goes through, right? Why not be the blueprint? Yeah. Why not be the voice of reason? Why not be, you know, the woman that can talk to your daughter or can talk to her friends? And I've had those conversations, and I've literally told my daughter, her friends, read the book. Read the book. These things can happen. I was, you know, here I am almost 50 years old, and I can say, you know, I may not have been trafficked, but I had someone kidnap me, bring me into their home. I had to live with them and literally had to sleep with this man every single day. The man who tried to murder me. And literally having to write, I was no Tina, he was no Ike. This was my real life. I got to get out of here. I have to go. And to be in that situation at 16 and 17 and, you know, wanting to pick up a gun, and, you know, with someone laying on top of you, choking the life out of you, wanting to murder somebody, like, I want to kill you. And the life being sucked from you. If I can be that blueprint, use me. Use my story. Learn from it. Get something from it. Gain something from it. I did.
When was a moment in your life where you felt you were starting to turn around? When you saw actually legitimate? Because every now and then in the book, it's like, oh, something good happened. This family took me in and they prayed for me and everything was great. And it's kind of funny. The book is really interesting because there are many points in the book where it's like, oh, this is about to become a religious lesson. And it actually like, and I'm like, and then Jesus came in and blah, blah, blah. But then the family sucks and I'm back on the street. You know, it's like, it's not what one would think where it's like, and then Jesus came over and everything was great. Like a lot of times the families are really fucked up and they don't help you like you thought they would. So like, and I kind of dig that actually. Like, was there a moment in your life when you actually legitimately for the first time were like, I can turn this shit around?
Recently.
Wow, really?
Yeah, recently. Life has thrown some major bricks. It's thrown some major bricks. And for a long time, you know, again, you're reading the book, so you're saying, hey, God this, God that. Me and God didn't see eye to eye for a long time. Like, hey, I was being raped. Where were you?
Right.
I was being molested. Where were you? This guy beat the shit out of me. Where were you? And every time I felt like I was getting to that place of healing and turning this shit around, something else happened. Something else transpired. And so just recently, I went through dealing with the narcissist and being mentally abused recently. And I'm writing my bestseller. And this moment in my life is where I'm getting this shit together. I never really wanted to have a regular job. I had to get a regular job. My life was about hustling. My life was about getting out there, getting money. My life was, I'm going to get it how I live. I lived the Malcolm X creed by any fucking means necessary. And so now the way I look at my life, and to answer your question, now is where it's go time. Now is I'm changing this shit. I'm turning this shit around. I'm taking my power back. It's go time. The beast is about to emerge. The woman that I've always wanted to be. I will probably not always have a regular job. I do have dreams of being a best-selling author, to write books, to write movies, to inspire, to have, you know, my own facility, apartment complex for women who are raped, abused, coming out of prison. You know, there's not a lot of resources. And then there are a lot of resources. It just depends on which way the wind decides to blow with the government, right? Or is there help? But, you know, I have bigger dreams. I have bigger goals. But yes, now is the time is where I feel in my life where I'm changing my shit.
I texted you this and I was really concerned it would come off the wrong way, but I don't think it did, which is I bought your book because you had a relationship with Tupac. It was by far the least interesting part of your book, in my opinion. Like, I found your life and your journey far more interesting than your experiences with Tupac. And that's not to diminish your experiences with Tupac.
Right.
And I was wondering, like, because the book kind of, you know, the back, you have a quote on the back about, you know, you had an excerpt on the back of the book cover about Tupac. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you feel the same way I do and you just wisely thought, well, a good way to help sell the book is to, is that fair?
That's fair.
All right, cool. Fair.
You know, I didn't want to embellish on my relationship.
No.
You know, my relationship was personal. My relationship was mine. It wasn't for the world. In the book, I don't embellish on the relationship. I don't talk about my intimate moments. I don't talk about moments that people have asked on to, like, how was he? Or was he good? You know, those things I keep very, very private, because here's the thing. He, and in our text message, as I said, he's everything that a woman like myself needed, whether it was the boyfriend, the friend, the father figure, you know, everything that a woman like myself needed. He was all of those things, the provider, the go-to person, the ear, you know. So the personal and intimate relationship, that wasn't for everybody. But I needed that to be a part in the book that spoke not only my truth, but how my life actually changed and why my life changed and why my life continues to change. He will forever be a pivotal point, a pivotal person, a pivotal thing in my life. Even to this day, I'll look at his picture, you know, on the fireplace, or open, you know, my book, or, you know, every now and again, I'll look at some of the letters and, you know, I'll read them, or it's always something. But that part of the book, I didn't want to make so long and drawn out, because that relationship wasn't long and drawn out. It was what it needed to be for me. It was the most exciting, unrealistic thing that could happen to somebody like me, right? You wake up and you're like, I knew Tupac? I dated Tupac? Tupac was my friend? He was my mentor? Who gets to say that? I'm not a celebrity. I'm not in the movies. I'm not, you know, some viral phenomenon. I'm a regular woman from South Philly with two kids, living her life on her terms. So to have that connection and to have that relationship, I keep the very intimate parts of that relationship very, very private, because the only thing that I'll ever have are those memories. In the book, as I said, I could not believe, to this day, it's like I say it and it's still like, wow, to be a part of hip hop's royalty and look around in your world is no longer the horror scene in a movie.
Right.
It's this. What is this? This shit is real.
Right.
This shit is real. And, you know, the connections and the relationships that were forged by knowing him. That was my life. Was that real? And again, to have Tupac say, it'll be when I'm dead and gone when they believe you.
You decide I'm going to write this book.
Uh-huh.
Write the book. Do you try going to a publisher? Do you know you're going to self-publish it? How do you sort of actually go about creating the book?
Well, I wanted to go the publishing route. I wanted to get this book published. I wanted it to be, a big thing. But the reality was, speaking to different publicists, speaking to different people, you know, reaching out to people that I knew, reaching out to people that I knew in the industry, nobody wanted to help. And so because no one wanted to help, the people that did, or the person that did, that was the route that we decided to take, because it was as if no one believed in the story. No one believed that it would sell, and no one believed that it was good enough. I even had John Singleton. I remember when I met John Singleton, and I wanted to turn the book into, before the book had even saw the light of day, I presented him with this story about my life. And I remember John looking at me and us having this conversation, and it was the hardest thing that I had to stomach. The story is cliche.
What the fuck is cliche about your story?
I don't know, but you know, we had this conversation, and I had written some stuff down on the paper. It wasn't the full manuscript, it wasn't the full book, but it was, you know, it was what I had to present at the time. And he looked at me and he said, it's cliche. And I really wanted it to be a movie. Like, I still want it to be a movie. And I think that it has its potential. And the reason I think the book has its potential is because a lot of people don't know the real story behind what really happened when Tupac went to prison. And a lot of movies have been put out there.
Wait. I'm sorry. I 100% disagree with you. I don't think Tupac is the story here. I think your story is insane. I want to say this. I'm sorry. I'm actually going to get mad at you and lecture you. I'm sorry. You were raped at 6. Your mom beat the shit out of you. You had a pimp basically try to prostitute you. You become a stripper. You're homeless. You have this insane, unbelievable, unfathomable journey. Mm-hmm. And we are sitting here today, thanks to this thing called Zoom, talking from probably 1,500 miles apart. And you're like this mom with 2 kids and really cool glasses. Like, you are an amazing, amazing success story. And like, I don't give a shit what you say. Like, Tupac is the least interesting part. I swear to God, your narrative is so inspiring. Fuck John Singleton.
Right.
Fuck Tupac. Your story is your story. And it's an amazing saga. Seriously.
I get it. But here's the truth. Yeah. Here's the truth. And the reason, you know, I speak so highly of Pac is because he was the one person that said that this would happen when I didn't believe it. And, you know, no, it's not about Pac. The book is not about Pac. As you read, you know, it's very short. The story about Pac and the relationship with Pac is very, very short. But when I say, you know, there's a lot that people don't know. My life has been what it is because there was one man out of all the men that have abused me, or, you know, the relationships that I've, there was one man that showed me that there are still good men in this world, despite what people thought that he went through. Right. And what you're telling me is the very thing that he would tell me. This is your life, Pooch. This is what you went through. So, you know, in telling my story, I want women to know, I want people to know that there is always that one person in your life, that one person that won't abuse you, that won't lie to you, that'll keep it real, that will believe in you, that will continue to make connections beyond the grave. That is my truth. I still do interviews. I still, you know, talk to people. Yes, I have a regular job. Yes, I still walk in my dreams. I still walk in my shoes. I'm still walking my path. But I still have that one person in the back of my head that I'll get a call or an interview or something will happen and they'll be like, hey, I read your book or whatever. And it's always, I read it, but what was this like? And to have that one man that I named in my book be the person that he was for me, be the person that he was to me, and to believe in me. To this day, you know, for a long time, I didn't believe in myself. And to hear, you know, him saying something on the phone or, you know, it's crazy because no matter what I went through in my life, here's this one man that it's like, you got to do this, because if no one else believed in you when you didn't even believe in yourself, this man saw something in you. And you have to tell not only your story, but a portion of his.
Fair enough.
It's a small portion.
All right, fair enough.
But when you tell your story, you have to tell a portion of theirs, because a portion of theirs is entangled in yours.
Let me ask you a final question. So usually on this podcast, when I have sports writers on, I ask them, what's the worst confrontation they had with an athlete? I'm going to go total curveball on you. I'm looking at you and I see your hands and you have these super long, cool nails. Now, you also have on your left hand a tattoo right along the finger, kind of the knuckly side there. What is the most painful tattoo you have and what did it feel like?
You could ask the sports question because I have dated somebody in the sports world.
Take that too if you'd like. Yeah.
The most painful tattoo. I mean, I felt pain. So I don't think I felt a lot of pain with tattoos. So let me see. The back of my neck.
Did it really hurt?
Mm-hmm. I have an evil sun on the back of my neck.
All right, let's see. You got to move. All right, let's see now. Oh, there it is. Okay. And why'd you get the evil sun? What caused you to get the evil sun?
Because that's how I woke up every single morning.
What do you mean?
I felt that the world was an evil place. And when the sun rose and set on my ass, it was an evil place because I had to wake up and see the sun every day. I wish death would find me. I wish that death would come and get me. And so when I saw the sun, I felt like the sun was evil because it was another day that I had to live a tragic life.
Do you still feel that way? Or are you?
I don't, but and that's why it's on the back of my neck.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see the sun anymore, right? Meaning I don't see that sun.
Right.
It's the evil sun, which is, you know, I don't want to wake up in the morning. So, you know, that will be a tattoo that is always there that is a reminder, but there was also a reasoning behind it because I literally one day wanted to feel that waking up in the morning was the most beautiful thing. And it is. I have two children that get on my damn nerves and they're spoiled and I have four dogs. And so when I see the sun in the morning, it's the most beautiful thing. It's the most beautiful thing ever. Because I get to wake up and see pieces of me that I've brought into this world. So the sun that rises and sets on my back is no longer the evil sun. It's just the sun.
That's awesome. Here's what I love about the world. I'm being serious. Like, you and I have had completely 1,000,000% different life experiences. Mm-hmm. And like, your beautiful book brought us together and we've had this lovely conversation. Jewish sports writer in Southern California, author in Texas who's gone through hell. And we're sitting here. And that's a really cool thing. And I just want to say sincerely, I got so much out of this book. I thought it was heartbreaking and gripping, but also weirdly hopeful. And I didn't find Jesus reading it, but I can respect the search. And I just thought, like, I just think it's a really worthwhile read. And I really, truly, truly, truly appreciate you not only writing it, but taking the time to talk to me about it.
Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed you. You're awesome.
I want to thank today's guest, Dahlia McCutcheon, for joining me on Two Writers Sing and Yang. You can follow Dahlia on Instagram at Dahlia McCutcheon and purchase I Testify wherever books are sold. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Writers Sing and Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be most grateful. Music is by the sizzling MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep writing.